You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio 2 here at Monocle 24 with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we're in Berlin to hear whether the Eurobond plan to save the continent's economy is already dead in the water. How the branding police at the International Olympic Committee have extended their reach into the home knitting market. And why Brazil's prison inmates are finding that redemption can indeed lie within, as their sentences are commuted for reading novels and then writing essays while locked up.
You can become a very good person, a better person, reading books. And I'm very happy that the state of Brazil is incentivating it for our inmates.
Plus, we're in Menorca to check in with our culture editor, Rob Bound, and we hear more about the Air Berlin pilots who made a distress call for a priority landing because they said they were too tired to fly around waiting for a landing slot.
This, I think, is unique, but we may see more of these because in the end, the pilots are the people that stand between us and a smoking hole in the ground.
All that plus some great music too in the next hour here on Midori House live on Monocle 24. So with that reassuring quote hanging in the air, it's time to get some news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Recep Erdogan has said today that Turkey will not hesitate to respond to any hostile attack. His remark came after the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said his country was in a real state of war. While tensions have mounted between Turkey and Syria after the downing of a Turkish military aircraft by Syrian air defences last week, which gave a new international dimension to the worsening conflict in Syria. Meanwhile, Radwan Ziadia of the opposition Syrian National Council said the group is seeking ways to put more pressure on Washington to help protect civilians in Syria.
It's our aim and goal to establish a Syria working group or a Syrian caucus within the Congress. It's non-partisan. Both can work together to help the Syrian people and to put some pressure on the administration to make a shift in its policy. Our mission, it's clear that the U.S. have to do some actions. Everyone is looking for the U.S. leadership. Everyone is expecting for the United States to do more actions to protect the civilians in Syria.
African Union troops have seized a rebel stronghold near Mogadishu from al-Qaeda-linked insurgents today, marking a major blow against the al-Shabaab rebels who have used the town to stage sporadic attacks on the capital. According to African Union Uganda contingent commander Paul Lekech, they are progressing well in enforcing the AU's mandate in Somalia.
This morning we decided to move from El Fitri to ensure that we capture Balad. We got Balad in the morning. By 8 we are already in Balad. Our mission is to liberate Balad as per my plan of Operation Free Shabelle. The objective is to ensure that we free Somalia from the hands of Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab will not dictate the life of Somalians. Somalians need freedom, Somalians need happiness. And this is the time we need to bring peace again in Somalia.
Italy's government has won a fourth and final vote of confidence on its contested labour reform today, speeding its passage into law a day before Prime Minister Mario Monti attends a European Union summit in Brussels on the future of the euro. The actor Hugh Grant has spoken today at a pan-European forum on media pluralism in Brussels and called on European Union regulators to restrict the influence of media moguls such as Rupert Murdoch.
We can get some movement at EU level to produce a directive for EU member states on maximum percentages of the newspaper industry or the television industry or the radio industry that one individual can own.
Giant Olympic rings were unveiled here in London today to mark a month to go to the Olympic Games. London's Mayor Boris Johnson watched as a giant set of interlocking Olympic rings were eased into place on Tower Bridge across the River Thames.
I think we're in as good a position as any Olympic city has ever been at this stage, and that's a great tribute to the organising committee to everybody who's been involved. Clearly, there are, you know, it's the final furlong. This is when the horses start to change places. It will make the difference between a good games and the best games ever, but I'm sure we're going to pull it off.
And finally, nearly 50,000 coins thought to have been hidden away from Julius Caesar's advancing army by the British Celts have been found on Jersey in the Channel Islands. Each coin is thought to be worth up to £200, making the find potentially worth £1 million. They are believed to date from the late Iron Age and the year 50 BC. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much, and apologies for your microphone is sort of coming and going there. But the thing I like about that last story of yours is that these two chaps have been doing the same thing, repeated coin finding, for 30 years.
And they finally make it.
Persistence.
Persistent pays off.
It does pay off, certainly for them, up to £1 million. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll have the latest on Europe in a moment. But first on Midori House, for the latest on Europe's economic crisis. The idea of a Eurobond issue as a mechanism for multiple countries to share the financial load and risk of supporting the likes of Greece and Spain in the continent appears to be consigned to being an idea rather than a reality forever. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel yesterday ruled out the use of Eurobonds for, quote, as long as I live. And as she and the French President François Hollande meet in Paris tonight, warnings come from Spain as their Prime Minister says his economy cannot continue funding itself for a long period at current yields. Well, joining us on the line from Berlin is Quentin Peel, that city's bureau chief for the Financial Times. Good evening, Quentin.
Hello.
What do you see as the play here politically? What's going on?
Well, I think that Chancellor Merkel is making a big song and dance about Eurobonds. Because she knows that actually just about everybody else has already accepted she's not going to move on that. And it leaves her a little bit of wiggle room so that there may be some sort of last-minute compromise that might be able to use funds to help out with Spain and Italy in the bond markets, maybe bond buying, or maybe making it slightly easier for them to recapitalize their banks. I think that Chancellor Merkel is going to have to do something. The trouble is, it's almost certain to be too little too late, and the markets will go away deeply unimpressed. I think that the pressure is certainly on her. She's very tough. She's going to negotiate right to the end. But if the others make concessions to her, I think she may have something in her back pocket.
Mm. Well, we'll talk about the markets and what they're after in just a moment. I want to ask you whether it's your assessment that she's behind the game or sort of really leading it.
I think she's still leading the game. I think that she is the one who has to be persuaded. She's the one who has the deepest pockets. And so however much Ms. Mario Monti from Italy or Mariano Rajoy from Spain may huff and puff, at the end of the day, she's going to be the one who decides whether things are dire enough and they've done enough to actually qualify for easier treatment.
Mm. Okay, well, tell us, let's move to the markets, as you were just saying there a little earlier. Some of them might be off for their summer holidays shortly enough, but they'll be replaced by maybe juniors who are even less patient than their seniors. They really can't wait. They want immediate action, is that right?
Well, I think so. I mean, the trouble is there are two sorts of people in the markets. They're the traditional bond investors who are frightfully conservative. They're pension funds. They're people who just want something safe. And then they're the more speculative hedge funds and so on who are looking for something profitable. Mm. And I'm not sure that they're pulling in the same direction. I think that Angela Merkel is trying to bid for, if you like, the conservative ones to come back into the market. What happens, the funny thing that happens in the summer, is that turnover gets very thin And then, of course, that rather exaggerates movements, whether they're up or down, because there's not a lot of money about in the markets. So that's always a bit problematic, but on the whole, I think they quieten down, and these juniors you mentioned are probably kept on a pretty short rein.
Yes, well, certainly, I mean, they'd have no patience with another summit that turns up deciding not very much at all.
Well, the trouble is that everybody says in advance, this summit is not going to do any big bazooka treatment. This summit is not going to come up with a big deal. And yet, day in, day out, people who are investing in the market seem to think, oh no, come on, they must do something. They're going to do something. And certainly sitting in Berlin, it's a very funny place to be because, you know, the attitude here is, why should we do anything? Hang on, there's absolutely no reason to do anything. We've got nothing to gain. It would be pouring good money after bad. What we want is to make sure that Italy, Spain, Greece, Portugal, you name it, do the domestic reforms to get their house in order so that actually they will regain the confidence of investors. And that's what they need to do. Hang on, we Germany have got the confidence of investors. So we don't think that short-term action makes any difference. Angela Merkel was in the German parliament today and she called sort of short-term measures eyewash. She was pretty rude about it.
Yes, and I'm interested in what the feeling is in Berlin towards the Merkel-Hollande relationship and how that's actually progressing in the light of actually making some progress in the area. What's your feeling on how they're viewing François Hollande's leadership on this?
I think there's quite a lot of nervousness. I think he's playing quite hardball in a way that they've got unused to, because towards the end anyway, Nicolas Sarkozy had actually pretty much done whatever Angela Merkel wanted him to do. Mm. Now you've suddenly got a man who's making politics, who's making waves, who's not yet used to this cosy relationship with Berlin, and actually is also a bit uncomfortable. I'm convinced that they will get their act together because actually, it was the leader of the opposition here in Germany who said to me yesterday, it's unimaginable for them to turn up the summit arguing with each other. Well, it has happened before, but many years ago. And I think they'll probably do a deal together tonight. They're having dinner in Paris tonight. They'll come up with some sort of compromise. May not look very impressive, but it'll be enough to say we're still moving forward.
Now, turning to Spain and Portugal, and while most people in that country will be watching those two nations battle it out together on a football pitch somewhere in Poland or the Ukraine, I'm not quite sure where it is, apologies for that, not sure I follow it particularly as keenly as they will be, but where will they be in terms of their positions as the Spanish Prime Minister? You might argue that today is a good day to declare some good euro or bad economic news. Where will they be on this statement that Spain can't hang on forever under current yields?
Well, he is very, very keen to get some action taken that will reduce the yields, the interest rate spreads he's having to pay in the market. And if it goes back over 7%, it's very uncomfortable. I'm afraid the German attitude is rather tough. They say, look, you could pay 7% for a year and your overall borrowing costs would only go up by about 0.5 percentage point. So why are you so desperate? But certainly Mr. Rajoy is stepping up the pressure to get some relief. And I think the same we're hearing very much from Mario Monti. In each case, it's a bit of, there's Angela Merkel sitting there, incidentally, you know, the one strong woman in a whole bunch of male suits, and looking at them and saying, well, you bloody well prove you've done what it takes domestically. Monti's going to turn up in Brussels tomorrow and he's going to say, well, look, I've done the labour reforms. And they're actually going to look at the labour reforms he's done and saying, they're not very brave, are they? You haven't really been quite radical enough to get rid of the old feather bedding that you've got in your labour market and so on. I'm not sure you've done enough. So this is the way she keeps up the pressure. It's both actually facing down the demands and using the pressure of the markets to get reform. It's a gamble, though, and she can't do it forever because the pressure of the markets will get too great for them.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much for that, Quentin. That's Quentin Peel, Bureau Chief, Berlin Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, joining us live there from the German capital. Thank you. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 14 minutes past the hour.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Antwerp Academy of Fashion has a reputation for turning out some of the most cutting-edge designers of the day. It's where rising stars are discovered and a heady place to witness the impulses of Generation Next. We travel to Antwerp to scout out students on the threshold of success.
Fashion for me, first of all, it's a research. It's a research about the human, it's research about who they are, how they think. I start really looking up for images of sleeping beautiful woman. Surprisingly, I found it in horror movies. So all the pieces are made with a red thread only. If you come closer, you will see that the blood really runs in a garment.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in our program archive on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, flying the world can be a tiring experience, depending perhaps on where you sit on the plane, but one hopes the men and women at the pointy end, keeping the thing in the air, are well rested. Well, it's emerged that pilots commanding an Air Berlin flight declared a pan call. That's one step below an emergency, because they consider themselves to be too tired to manually land the aircraft. The Airbus A330 from Palma de Mallorca was just 12 minutes from touching down in Munich last month when the crew made the call. The autopilot was switched on and the aircraft landed happily without further incident. So is this an example of where the aviation world is going as the airlines squeeze utilisation out of their assets to the maximum? Well, to find out more, Matt Barbette spoke earlier to David Learmount, the operations and safety editor of Flight International magazine, and started by asking about his thoughts on this Air Berlin incident.
Pilots are working harder than they've ever done before, and I'm talking about in the entire history of aviation, airline pilots. I think you only have to look at the operating philosophy of low-cost carriers like Ryanair and EasyJet to know that the whole model entails getting the most out of people and the most out of the machinery. Now, that's a perfectly valid business model, but it does mean that the risks of fatigue, we are going to encounter more of those the longer we operate a system like this. And I think we will always operate a system like this.
Conversely then, do you think it's easier for those pilots who are actually flying long haul and across many time zones?
Well, when you're flying long haul and across lots of time zones, if it's a really long haul flight, you have an augmented crew. That means you have at least one more pilot on board so that the pilots can take a break, and they even have bunks to sleep in so they can get a few hours kip during a very long flight. So there are all sorts of fatigue risk management systems that the industry has in place. If you're in a safety-critical job like a pilot and you recognize that fatigue is beginning to affect your performance, i.e. you make a mistake and you recognize it and you deal with it, but you're just about to start your descent into an airport and you're thinking, hell, I've made a couple of mistakes, I'm making these mistakes because of fatigue. I really don't want any additional complications during this approach, so I'm going to tell the controller that this is how things are.
Is it unusual to do that? And will these pilots lose the respect of others for using the system simply because they're tired?
This event is unique, okay? I've never heard of this happening before. And incidentally, I've been in aviation for nearly 50 years. But the fact is that because pilots are now working longer and harder than they've ever done before, fatigue is a bigger risk. So when fatigue wasn't the same risk that it is now, we wouldn't have got events like this.
Mm.
This, I think, is unique, but we may see more of these. I can tell you this, some people have thought, because there is an argument going on, the European Aviation Safety Agency is in the process of reviewing rules which would enable pilots to work longer than they do. And the pilot unions are all desperately against this. And there are those who are alleging that this crew was trying to do a publicity stunt for the pilot unions. That is ridiculous. Pilots do not act like this. If the union was going to do something, they wouldn't have a single crew doing it. They'd have crews doing it all over Europe. So let's just forget that this was a publicity stunt. These people did this for a very good reason, and that reason should be investigated.
On the other hand, David, you know, it's not like driving a car, is it, that you have to be in control the whole time you're travelling somewhere. There is autopilot, and some would argue that perhaps pilots have a fairly easy life of it on the whole.
Yes, again, a good probing question there. Yes, I mean, they just sit around twiddling their thumbs. I mean, it's not any longer a physically demanding job, but I think everybody's aware of the fact that fatigue isn't usually a physical thing. It's a mental thing. Now, we've all done it. You're driving along the motorway and you can feel your eyelids closing. And, you know, I don't know whether any of you have been woken up by the, you know, you've been just literally tipping over the edge and you've been woken up by the rumble strip. If that can happen to you when you've got the road rushing towards you, you've got lights flashing by, you've got cars surrounding you, and you can still do that. Now, imagine yourself on an autopilot in a dark sky way up there and nothing's happening. You're just looking at the dials. How much easier would it be to nod off then without realizing you're doing it? You have much less stimulation. And then, all of a sudden, you realize you have to start descending toward your destination. Now, there's a lot of decision-making involved, and you don't have a road to guide you. You've got to make all your navigation decisions yourself in three dimensions, okay? You might be descending into a valley. You don't want to hit the mountains. They tend to be pretty hard.
They certainly do. That was the wisdom of David Learmount, Operations and Safety Editor of Flight International magazine, talking to our Matt Barbette a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now to Sao Paulo, Brazil, where some of the country's most dangerous prisoners in the roughest federal penitentiaries are turning to a good book to lighten both their soul and their prison sentences. Authorities are offering their inmates 4 days less cell time for every book they read, once a well-worded essay has been written to prove the piece has indeed been read and consumed. Well, just before we came on air, I spoke to André Kedi, a Sao Paulo lawyer, who's part of the foundation that's promoting and providing these books for the prisons of Sao Paulo. He started by outlining his recent work.
In this institute, we have a project about creating libraries inside the penitentiary system in the prisons. So we are. It is going on for 2 years, and with this project, I have gained some information about what is going on in the penitentiary system, especially about the libraries. Not all of our prisons have books for the inmates. So we are donating it and creating libraries inside. That's why I can tell you something about the books inside the penitentiary system.
Okay, well, please do, yes. Tell us what kind of books you're putting in these penitentiaries.
All kinds of books. They are donations. So if you have some books in your house that you don't like, you just give it to us and we can deliver it in the penitentiary system. Actually, in São Paulo, in our state, is where our project is going on. The director of the prison, they do a kind of censorship about the books. And we have lots of prisons here, so in each prison you have a kind of rule. Sometimes they don't like that you deliver books about laws for the inmates.
Mm.
And the main part of the donations, there are no problems. We deliver everything we receive.
Indeed.
This is happening in some of Brazil's toughest prisons, and I can imagine some of the conditions in some of these largest prisons have been pretty difficult.
Yes, it is going on just in the federal prisons. In Brazil, we have just 5 federal prisons. In these, they sent the most dangerous prisons of Brazil. But because it is they are federal prisons, they have a lot of money, so they have a very good infrastructure. Okay, this is very different from the prisons from the states of Brazil. They are very poor, and they have no infrastructure.
And just tell us, Andre, how does it work? How can prisoners get some of their sentences shortened?
For each book read by the inmate, in 20 days, from 20 to 30 days, if he can do it, and he writes a review about the book, he can redeem 4 days of his sentence. And in the whole year, he can redeem, he can read 12 books and redeem in the maximum 48 days of his sentence.
And Andre, that sounds great for them. And is your hope and the hope of those governing the prisons is that actually we will make people leave prison better people?
Oh, Ted, I think it's a very good thing to do here in Brazil to incentivize them to read books. In Brazil, not inside the prison, but outside the prison, we don't have the most part of our population doesn't have this costume to read the books, and I think that it's clear that if they read lots of books, they will get out of there much better persons. And I hope that this program will go on very strongly and not go on just inside the federal prisons, but in the state prisons as well, because it's very good, it's very important. And I think the one who is inside the prison, he can gain a lot about that. I was reading actually the biography of Gandhi, and I saw that when he was inside prison, he used to read lots of books. Okay, so it's a great person. Everyone knows him, and it's a very good example for the whole world, but actually here in Brazil, that you can get good and become a very good person, a better person, reading books. And I'm very happy that the state of Brazil is incentivizing it for our inmates.
That was André KD talking to me a little earlier about commuting prison sentences in return for literacy and reading books in Sao Paulo prisons. You're listening to Midori House, and to continue the Brazilian theme, here's a bit of music. It's Gabi Amarantos with Chuva. That's Gabi Amarantos with Chuva from her new album Treme, which was out in April. I'm sure they'll all be tapping their toes to that in Sao Paulo's penitentiaries as they read their novels. Right, more to come on the Midori House today, including whether Olympic branding restrictions are going too far. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Ted. The Turkish Prime Minister said today that Turkey will not hesitate to respond to any hostile attack. His remarks came after the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said his country was in a real state of war. Meanwhile, the opposition Syrian National Council said the group is seeking ways to put more pressure on Washington to help protect civilians in Syria. African Union troops have seized a rebel stronghold near Mogadishu from al-Qaeda-linked insurgents today, marking a major blow against the al-Shabaab rebels who've used the town to stage sporadic attacks on the capital. Italy's government has won a fourth and final vote of confidence on its contested labour reform today, speeding its passage into law a day before Prime Minister Mario Monti attends a European Union summit in Brussels on the future of the euro. The actor Hugh Grant Grant has spoken today at a pan-European forum on media pluralism in Brussels and called on European Union regulators to restrict the influence of media moguls such as Rupert Murdoch. And here, giant Olympic rings have been unveiled in London to mark a month to go to the Olympic Games. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much, and more news in about 28 minutes' time. Now, every day on Midori House, we lure one of Monocle's editors downstairs here into Studio 2 or 1 when we're in there, or from the editorial floor to talk us through what's in their section of the current issue and what they're working on now. Wednesday means culture, which means Robert Bound, and despite from some top-level luring, it turns out he's not upstairs at all, but on the Balearic island of Menorca, from where he joins us now. Hi, Rob.
You need a very glittery lure, Ted, to get me into Studio 2 from Menorca. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm very well, I know. We need that, and we need maybe some tempting you down with some, I don't know, custard creams or something. That's Portuguese, really, not so much on Menorca. But tell us what you're up to there.
This is more cocktail hour here now.
Now you're there for Mediterranean.
I'm out here doing some pretty hard work. I've got my nose to the ground and to the grindstone doing some research for Monocle Mediterraneo, which will be coming out next month, which we're sort of putting to bed at the moment. But I managed to whiz off to Menorca for a couple of days to check out one of my stories, which is going to be in that issue, which is about beach clubs that turn into nightclubs. So it's a kind of tough job, but someone had to do it, Ted.
Well, indeed. But I like the idea of a beach club that turns into a nightclub. It's a mix of clientele, really, because you get an early kind of scene at the beach club. It's families. It's perhaps more, well, let's say retirees that come down there to improve on their leather skin. And they're not really the types that might stay on for the nightclub.
Well, exactly, it is. And we're sort of at that crossing point at the moment. I actually wandered out of the place. I've actually come to Menorca to Cala de Portas. To a place called Cova d'Onjeroi, which is this amazing bar which is snuck in to the high cliff face, and it's sort of chiseled out of the rock, and it's got a sort of, it's one of those places that you can walk up to with a kind of with a stout walk, but walking back might prove to be a little bit more difficult because it's down a sort of windy staircase through the cliff, and that's where the beach club part is. And at the moment it's still really warm here. It's 7:30 here in Spain. And yeah, exactly. It's that point at which the kind of beach people are going home to have their shower before dinner, and the younger kids are kind of running up the steps to get some sundowners in, which is what I'm going to plan to do in a second.
Well, very nice. And certainly from the last beach club that I was in, which was in Cap Ferrar, just between Nice and Monaco, you could certainly tell that time. Yeah, do you know it?
I know, Cap Ferrar, exactly. Yeah, no, it's it might be a little bit more shishy, Ted, Cap Ferrar, than this place. But this is sort of, it's got a rustic charm about it, which I'll tell you all about. I'll test out and report back. This is kind of a nice thing, though. I mean, I'll be speaking to a couple of the DJs later. I'm trying to make sure you now know that it's a culture story here, not just a holiday. I'll be speaking to some of the DJs and talking about the tracks that I'll be spinning later on as well, which will go into Monocle Mediterranean's kind of summer playlist as well. So that's kind of, there'll be some note taking. Don't you worry, it won't just be sundowners. There'll be pen and paper as well.
Oh no, I trust there will be. And no, I don't think it's possible to get anywhere on earth more shishi than Saint-Jean Cap Ferrar. But
exactly. But
tell us just about Menorca in general. You know, you've got Ibiza, you've got Mallorca, and then is the feeling it's a bit more of a laid back place? Is it the embarrassed third brother of the Balearics?
I don't know. I kind of feel like it's sort of one of those places, I think, which is possibly undergoing a bit of a revival. There's a lot of new build in this town, Cala de Portas. The best thing about it, I think, is probably this bar. There's a lot of, it was obviously new 70s new build stuff, and it's the sort of Brits and German crowd and there's a lot of sort of hotel, purpose-built hotels and things. But that sort of seems to be turning around, because I think younger people are sort of coming, realizing that it's sort of cheap and that the beaches are beautiful, the countryside's equally beautiful, and as kind of built up as some of the bits of coastline are, there's a huge amount of the minor to the Mallorca, that are really sort of undiscovered. So I'm going to go inland tomorrow to a place called Cereres, and have a look, and hopefully find some a bit more inspiration for our Mediterranean Odyssey there as well. So I'm going to dip my toe in the waters tomorrow morning and then get in a car and drive inland. But I think it kind of feels like it's sort of changing. But looking down on the beach as it is now, I can't see too many podgy sunburned people, Ted, I have to say. It's not exactly cap for rat, but, you know, it's going to have to do for this evening.
I'm sure you'll make the best of it. But talking of sunburn, do be careful. I'm sure if it's as hot as Valencia when I left it on Monday morning, it's pretty fierce out there.
Well, exactly. And like in Valencia, all the Spaniards, of course, in town tonight, like, hoping for a big Spanish victory in the Spain-Portugal match tonight, like you saw Alonso winning on Sunday in Valencia. So I've seen a few Spaniards wandering around wearing the shirt, which is, I think, nice to see. We'll see what happens after the game, Ted, and what the result is.
Well, especially against Portugal. But there's a very different meaning, I think, for a Spaniard to turn up wearing a football shirt is not quite as offensive to some people's eyes as perhaps an English chap turning up wearing an England shirt.
Yeah, I'm glad I haven't seen any of those, I have to say. I mean, I wouldn't want to say thank God we're out, but I'm glad I haven't seen any of the shirts on display here today. Although possibly a few people that might potentially sport one underneath a kind of Piccadilly stripe, maybe.
Yeah,
as a vest.
All right. I just don't understand why they make them so unashamedly nylon. I just think a nice cotton football shirt would be so much nicer.
You've got to breathe. I don't understand that. I know. They need to sort of have buttons on. I think that's the secret.
Do.
Anything that you can just pull on is something that's gobbly strange.
Okay, Rob, well, thank you very much. I could talk Menorca all evening, but I've got a producer shouting in my ear. So we'll let you go and have a good time. We'll read all about it in Mediterranean.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Ted Kravitz. Now, do Olympic branding rules go too far? In the run-up to the sporting event this summer, a range of companies have tried to get in on the Olympic spirit with varying degrees of success. Now, while the big brands pay big money to be associated with the Games, it seems the International Olympic Committee will do anything to protect their investments by clamping down on anyone who even alludes to an Olympic event in an Olympic year. Indeed, around the 2010 Vancouver Winter Games, the sportswear brand Lululemon managed to get around the restrictions by naming their sporting merchandise Cool Sporting Event that takes place in British Columbia sometime between 2009 and 2011. Well, one group who've been pushed into the spotlight is the knitting group Ravolympics. And joining us on the line from Arkansas, USA, is the group's co-founder Donna Bowman. Hi, Donna.
Hey, Ted.
So tell us, what's going on? Have you played it safe, or have you come a cropper with the IOC?
Well, I'm afraid we have. It's not the International Olympic Committee that has cracked down on us, but the U.S. Olympic Committee, which sent a cease and desist letter to the owners of the website Ravelry.com, which is a social networking site for knitters and crocheters. Over 2 million members, quite a large site. And they were demanding that the name Ravelympics, which we had used in 2008 and 2010, for a non-competitive knit-along and crochet-along that enrolled about 4,000 members the first year, 7,000 members the second year, be discontinued. And so we've been dealing with that for about the past 7 days.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. I hope it certainly wasn't for commercial gain. Just to make it clear, this is people doing home knitting.
Yes, absolutely. So this was a just a fun event to get people together to knit during the Olympic Games. And many people, in fact, knitted while watching the Olympics on television. And we had opening ceremonies. We had humorously named events such as the Afghan Marathon and the bag and tote backstroke. We tried to tie in different items that people could make and different destinations for their knitting, such as charity events, with the Olympic events, and it was definitely all in good fun.
Well, they must have been pretty expert knitters if they could take their eyes off their line and actually watch the events going off on television.
Yes, exactly. It's very impressive to watch someone going at it without even looking down at what they're working.
So what's your response going to be? I mean, are you minded to fight this?
Well, we were guided by the legal counsel of the website. The owner of the website, Casey Forbes, contacted his legal counsel early this week. And as you know, the trademark protections in this area are very strong. In fact, they're written not only into the copyright laws and the trademark laws, but into the laws of the country. So fighting it would not have been a good idea. And in fact, most people on the site recognize that the USOC and the IOC have to protect their brand. They have to go after people, because if you don't protect your brand, you're not going to win in court when you try to do so. So we were fine with that. The difficulty was that the cease and desist letter we got implied that knitting somehow denigrated the efforts of the athletes and the nature of the games. And this made a lot of the members of the site very angry. So there were thousands of messages on the USOC's Facebook page, hundreds of blog posts, thousands of Twitter messages. And in fact, we got two separate apologies from the United States Olympic Committee for that part of the cease and desist letter.
Well, indeed. And I suppose the action and then the publicity. I mean, here we are with listeners around the world, but we're based in London talking to you in Arkansas. And the attention can only shed some light on the absurdity of the whole situation.
Yes, I think there have been lots of instances that have pointed out the copyright craziness surrounding the Olympics, and this is just the latest one, because really, what could be more harmless than a group of knitters? I say sarcastically, we're really far from harmless, and we're far from the stereotype of grannies in rocking chairs. We certainly took to the social media waves and made a big splash in the last 7 days.
I mean, I guess you can understand, you know, there are very big companies who paid a lot of money to be associated. They're the only ones who are allowed to actually use the Olympic rings or things like triathlons or marathons or something like that. But I suppose you can't stop individual knitters putting the Olympic rings on their rugs or throws or teddy bears at home.
No, I suppose you can't. The difficulty comes in commercial use. So the cease and desist letter did point out that there are some knitting patterns and crochet patterns hosted on the Ravelry website, posted by individuals, not by the site itself, but the site is a database that collects links to patterns of all sorts, that did include the Olympic rings and were for sale. So the disposition of those patterns is yet to be determined.
Okay. Well, just tell us a lot of American interest in the London Olympics. We've just been hearing in the news it's all gearing up. There are various parts of the capital which are closed as they start building the facilities. Are you looking forward to it? Are you going to be looking out during the day and into the evening?
Absolutely. I've been an Olympics junkie for years. I attended the games in Atlanta in 1996 and in Los Angeles in 1984. And I will be watching and cheering them on and waving my knitting needles enthusiastically.
Okay, well, enjoy it. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Donna Bowman, co-founder of the knitting group Ravelympics, as you heard there, talking to us from Arkansas. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to go straight into some music now. This is Lana Del Rey, who's headlining at the Hove Festival in Norway, and this is National Anthem. Lana Del Rey and National Anthem, as we said, headlining the Hove Festival in Arendal in Norway later tonight. And she's on at 23:45, which is nice and late, before her Ed Sheeran and after the XX. So sounds like a pretty good festival lineup to me. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyoist. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντωστε καζίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London Bo, as a Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδάν, βουρεσε Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, Sie sind Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que nina teiro no a Monocle 24?
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagvecka.
51 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, a little earlier, Alistair Campbell, formerly Tony Blair's communications director, dropped by to Midori House to discuss his new book, The Burden of Power, with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Well, to hear the full interview, you'll need to tune in to this Sunday's edition of the Monocle Weekly. But in the meantime, we've managed to edit in a short preview to whet your appetite.
When Tony Blair spoke to the House of Commons in March on the day of the motion, he said, if Saddam gives up his weapons, as much as I don't like it, he can stay in power.
Yeah. No, but my point, I accept all that. My point is that it is a particularly big debate within Britain, this.
Well, because it was the reason that was given for why we went to war.
Because I'm accepting, and it wasn't the reason, I am accepting it was a major part of the argument. But it wasn't just the reason. There wasn't just one reason. And these things are always more complicated and they're never black and white. But I accept the argument that you're making that it was a big part of the case that we were making. And therefore, it's understandable that people say all the things that they say. All I can do, and I think the diary is helpful in this regard because it's contemporaneous, it's what he says and does on the day, and it's what I'm hearing and seeing. There was just no doubt. We had no doubt because of there's Tony Blair sitting there as the Prime Minister, and day after day after day after day, he's getting this picture presented to him of a growing threat, not a receding threat, of a growing threat.
Except also, day after day after day, he's receiving reports from Hans Blix's team saying, well, we're making some progress. We're not really finding much here. We're going to every site that your guys have said. We've gone to every site that the American guys have said.
No, they did find things. They did find things, but...
Well, no, but not...
No, but let me say something else about... I think the other thing that comes through about Hans Blix... In fact, Tony says this in terms at various points, is that Hans Blix had a job to do as the chief weapons inspector, the head of the weapons inspection. But actually there came a point where he became very political. And that actually did kind of muddy the waters a bit. There were discussions there that I describe where he was, in a sense, no longer seeing his role. This was our assessment, and maybe we're being unfair, but, you know, it was a very tense and difficult time. But our assessment was that, and Tony's sense was that he was... actually now saw his job, as it were, as to stop the war. Now, that may have been born of perfectly legitimate feelings and assessment and so forth, but actually his job was to inspect the weapons and to give a proper assessment. And so, in the end, this became, as Tony said on the MAR programme the other day, ultimately it was a decision. There was no conspiracy, there was no lying, it was a decision that ultimately he had to take.
Well, interesting. That sounds particularly juicy. That's Alistair Campbell there talking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield a little earlier on today. And you can hear that interview in full if you tune into this week's Monocle Weekly. That's on this Sunday on this station. Now, we are almost at the end of this edition of Midori House, but stay tuned because we're going to be talking what's on this evening's The Entrepreneurs in just a minute.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Hagat, ja.
Monocle 24, Jokoso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bro Pajalavet.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Now, as promised, let's get the latest on what's on this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, our business and enterprise programme with Jonathan Openshaw that's coming up in a few minutes. Joining us is Daniel Giacopelli. Daniel,
hello.
Well, good evening, yes.
Good evening.
What's up? What is on?
Well,
and what are we talking about?
We have a great show. We have Richard Florida. He's the author of The Rise of the Creative Class, a classic book. It's reissued now, the 10th anniversary. Jonathan talked with him. Really great chat. Our guy in Milan talked to the CEO, Fratelli Rossi, which is an Italian shoe company. Fantastic chat, actually. Check it out. And I actually went to Hampstead in northern London, and we talked to the head of this really cool letterpress company. Mm. It's this woman. She's doing this all by herself, and she's making these fantastic stationery and letters and envelopes. She has these really old presses, and she got this press from the great-great-grandson of William Caslon, who is the Caslon the font. Hmm. So he gave her this press, and that's how she got started.
You see, this is a fascinating thing, because letterpresses, and I mean, we know Smythe's, you could argue, London in the UK has led the world on speciality stationery, and certainly you have to pay
sure.
a certain amount for quality like that. But it's this kind of letterpress that's coming through, and a desire amongst people who appreciate, you know, proper graphics, and it's almost moved back 50 years into something that, you know, you can't get from modern technology. You can only get with this pre-war technology.
And you should see her do it. It's these amazingly beautiful machines, and it takes a lot of physical exertion too. I mean, she's she's not a large woman, and she's pressing down these huge metal panels, basically. Mm. And it's a beautiful craft, and you know, she's surrounded by all these blocks of wood and metal, and it's a really fun kind of. There's not many people doing this, to be honest. Mm. It's very popular in Brooklyn in the U.S., but in London, there's only like a handful of people really doing this.
Yeah, indeed. And some of them tend to do it for event posters and things like that, not necessarily for sort of personal stationery.
Exactly, yeah. Lots of wedding invitations, and you could get really creative with it.
I bet you could. Okay, anything else?
And our guy in New York, Barrett Austin, spoke with the CEO of Smallknot, and this is a way for businesses to get investment from people in their community. It's kind of a way of crowdsourcing investment. As opposed to crowdsourcing for a project, you can crowdsource for your local community, your local businesses that you find a need in. And it's kind of an innovative thing. It's just launched in New York at the moment.
Oh, see, that's interesting. And that itself, you know, brings back to sort of all these small businesses. And you mentioned the shoe, the footwear, what's it, the Fratelli
Rossi.
Yeah. But even so, you have in the UK, in Northampton, which these small businesses which specialize in sort of these kind of quality items. And I guess they need, you know, their patronage from somewhere. And this is
why
the
not
funding
get it from
that
the
they're
local...
going to get it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, thank you very much. That is The Entrepreneurs coming up in just a few moments. Well, as you can hear, that's about all we've got time for this edition of Midori House. The program was produced by Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager, Ben Jay. But from me, Ted Kravitz, for now, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Akute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.